Compliance is a profession where people work tirelessly to make the world a better place. And there are hundreds of amazing and inspiring women who have helped the field develop into what it is today. Great Women in Compliance is part of the Compliance Podcast Network as they talk with women in compliance who are making a difference.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Great Women in Compliance of 2024, sponsored by Corporate Compliance Insights and hosted on the Compliance Podcast Network. On behalf of Lisa Fine and the team here at Great Women in Compliance, we want to wish you, our Great Women in Compliance community, a very happy, peaceful and prosperous new year. My New Year's resolution is to spend more time with all of you at compliance community events and forums globally. So please reach out on LinkedIn and let's make this happen. Nothing fills my bucket more than spending quality time with inspiring humans. And on that point, we wanted to kick off 2024 by going big or going home. So we invited the unstoppable and inspiring Hayley Tedeschi to join us today. Welcome, Hayley.
Oh, Hema, thank you for that warm welcome.
Hayley is a senior anti-corruption counsel at Cisco, one of the largest technology companies in the world. Would you believe it? They have over 80,000 employees globally, and they are squarely in the Fortune 100. Hayley, before we kick in with questions, I wanted to say that you were also recently featured as a guest at a friend of mine's, Nick Gallo's Ethics Verse with Matt Kelly, another great ethics and compliance podcast that we recommend our listeners check out. And there they recognized your outsized impact with a stunning AI-generated superhero image. What did you think of that?
Incredibly flattering and a very fun take on compliance topic.
Look, here at GWIC, with AI images or not, you are listeners, you're superheroes every day. And we created this community to bring together inspiring women who work tirelessly to make the world a better place. Hayley, you are a phenomenal example of that, someone who's been doing this at scale. So welcome and happy new year to you.
Thank you. And it's so nice to be in your company.
Now, Hayley, we met at Georgetown Law School a few moons back. Oh, do you remember that?
Too many.
I think we were a co-counsel in a trial advocacy session, if I'm not mistaken, and did a few securities law classes together.
Absolutely. Some of the most fun that I had in law school, from what I remember.
I agree. And you were all so impressive back then. You're already ready for juries and trials. But since then, you've held so many big positions, all the big positions, corporate defense at big law, stints at big energy, petroleum, big telecom, and now big tech. So my first question to you is, what was the big plan at law school and how did we arrive here?
It's so interesting that you started with a reference to trial advocacy, because it had always been my dream and my long-term plan to work for the government, probably in either a regulatory or a prosecutorial capacity. And I think one of the greatest lessons that I've learned is to jump on opportunities that come your way, even if they're not part of the plan and what you expected, because you have no idea what doors they can open. And that's really what's happened with my career path. This was not the plan, but incredible opportunities knocked and I jumped.
So often I hear that it's not the plan and we find our way into this wonderful career in the compliance community. And I hear you on the trial advocacy. I also wanted to be a trial lawyer, and I was a trial lawyer for a while, but somehow moved away from that. I will say, when people ask me why I wanted to be a trial lawyer, I realized that advocacy is one skill that you just never stop improving on. And I'm sure, I don't doubt that you've used your advocacy skills many times in your compliance career. So we'll get to that for sure.
Yes, absolutely. I think the advocacy and the advisory piece, and that's what really drew the connection to being an in-house lawyer and advising and working so closely with the business. It was really that client service and the connection to people who are really facing risk on the ground that really drew me into this space.
Oh, you're so right. Because the thing about the trial attorney is it's just you, right? You are accountable. You have to give the advice. It's not really about you. It's about that client sitting next to you. And in some cases, their livelihood, they're like, it's on the line. So I love that analogy. We can give advice. We can take accountability and be the person in the room that does that. I love it. Well, there's no official compliance school at law school. Obviously, we probably weren't thinking about compliance at law school. So how did law school prepare you for this role, if at all? And if it didn't, what did?
That's a great question. I had no idea this space was even really out there when I was in law school. I had been a paralegal at a big law firm in New York before I went to law school. And I had, I think, a relatively simplistic view of the role that lawyers play in the business world and in private practice in terms of what the opportunities were there. I started my career as an insurance broker malpractice lawyer and thought after a couple years in, this can't be it. And attended some brown bag lunches and had always kept one foot in the white collar space. And I stumbled into the FCPA world about 3 years into my career. And then I never looked back. But I wouldn't say that I had really much exposure to this space at all in law school, though the skills, both from an analytical perspective and a writing perspective, that we developed at Georgetown have been absolutely invaluable over the course of my career, because it meant that no matter what areas I found myself in, I was ready to tackle it. And I had the core building blocks in place to be able to adapt.
That confidence and knowledge that you can tackle anything is, I think, critical to our career, because goodness knows anything can happen.
It's true. And we never know when the regulatory space is going to change or when regulators are going to change their focus. And so I feel over the last 10 years in particular, we had to really be flexible and be willing to learn and dive into new areas, whether it was sort of privacy when GDPR was coming online and all of the ways that impacts both investigations as well as compliance disclosures and third-party management practices. Then it was cybersecurity. Now we're seeing sort of the convergence and intersection of all different types of financial crime as national security issues. So it's kept things really fresh, and there's always something new to learn. So I'm very grateful to Georgetown that they gave us the education we needed to be able to continue to stay on the train and keep learning over the course of our career.
So true. I feel like part of being a grown-up for me is now acknowledging that I can do hard things. I can do them well.
Absolutely.
Nice to know. So you started a new role relatively recently at Cisco. Can you tell us what you're doing there?
Sure, absolutely. This is my first foray into true big tech, which is incredibly interesting for me. The team is a very wonderful group of legal and compliance risk management professionals. We have a fantastic data scientist and data analytics team, which has been a great collaborative effort as we take our data analytics program to the next level. And that's really where we've been focusing our efforts in the last few months, which is such an interesting and evolving space.
So important. And if you want to learn more about data analytics, I'm going to recommend people go over to the ethics first, because we are not going to talk about data today. As a lawyer, I try not to talk about data, but as you well know, we are required to think more and more about the data. And as you so rightly said to Nick and Matt, the information and the stories that the data can tell us and the question, how do we answer the questions that we're asking? So more on that on the ethics first. But let's talk about what you did prior to Cisco for a moment, because I know you were at Ericsson. And of course, I've got a lot of questions about Ericsson, interesting cases that came out of that company. But there, I think you were promoted to the head of strategy ops and monitor liaison office. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's a lot. Strategy ops and monitor liaison. I've got so many questions, but let's start with strategy. I would love to be known as strategic in my role. But what does that mean? What does that mean to you? And how did you develop strategy at Ericsson?
That's a topic that is incredibly close to my heart. There aren't unlimited resources in compliance, and no company has unlimited resources with respect to risk management. So in order to make investment decisions, you need to be particularly strategic about how you're advising the company to spend money and time and resources and where. You have to be strategic about the risks that you're going to prioritize and the risks that you're not, from both time and resources perspective, but also from a legal risk perspective and a reputational risk perspective. So I had an incredible gift in that role to be able to look at the panoply of particularly ethical and financial crime compliance risks that we faced, and help to devise and develop a long-term strategy so that the company and the stakeholders within the company and also externally had a clear view into the timeline and the pace at which the company was going to develop and further mature in its management of ethics and compliance risks. How do you go about doing that? Of course, you start with the risk assessment, right? First and foremost, you have to know what your risks are and where they are and their relative degrees of significance to the company's overall stability, operations, and reputation. And then you can take it there. I would say to anyone who might be out there and starting to develop a strategy for the first time, start with the DOJ's guidance on effective ethics and compliance programs, and ensure that you have a roadmap to have the important building blocks in place, particularly around culture, around engagement of your management at all levels of the company, because no matter what risk you are ultimately trying to manage or you are focusing on, if you have those core pieces in place from a culture perspective and from a business processes and controls perspective, everything else is essentially gravy. It will help to fill in the pieces, but if the company is well run and the culture is strong, you're going to be much better placed to manage whatever risks the company faces.
Never a truer word on the culture operations. Now, I think that's the meat of what we do, though, of course, right? Like you said, the rest can be gravy. We can get that part right. No, fascinating. It's a real testament to you that Ericsson chose to give you a role in strategy, because that's not easy to do. And I would love the title strategy one day. So congratulations that they chose you. I hear what you say, that it was a gift, because we do sometimes need to take a step back and figure out what we're doing, that we can have impact at scale.
Ericsson was subject of an enforcement action with the U.S. government back in 2019. And as part of that resolution, it was placed under initially a 3-year independent compliance monitorship. So while I was also responsible for strategy, I was also helping to manage overall implementation of the ethics and compliance program from an operational perspective and managing the independent compliance monitorship. Those roles might seem to be relatively unrelated or distinct roles, but really they're not, because the role of an independent compliance monitor is in large part to help the company develop a strategy and a long-term plan for ensuring that it has a robust ethics and compliance program in place to prevent potential misconduct in the future, recidivism or of another nature. And so to some extent, working so closely with the monitor and helping to manage the monitor's activities helped us to some extent to leverage that relationship and work together to really ensure that the company was on a long-term path to success. So it was incredibly valuable to have insights from external experts with decades of experience in a variety of industries who could provide advice, insight, and guidance into areas of enhancement and improvement for the program. And also to have that advice being provided directly to the business process owners within the company who are responsible on a day-to-day basis for managing those risks, not just the ethics and compliance organization, which was more what I had expected at the start of the monitorship. And over the course of time, you really come to realize how much of a collective effort ethics and compliance is, and that it cannot be done effectively without significant buy-in and ownership across the entire organization, certainly far beyond the legal team or the ethics and compliance team.
Oh, that's so insightful, because look, nobody wants to be under the crosshairs of the US government. But back to the point of gifts, sometimes it is a gift to have the experience of a monitor come and help you think about your strategy, like you said, in that collaborative way. I often think to myself, without needing to go there, it would be nice just to use our outside counsel or our consultants, our experts, to go through that journey anyway, somewhat of a pre-mortem, as my outside counsel calls it. Just get prepared anyway, be prepared, make sure that you are thinking of strategy rather than just being in the weeds. So very insightful. Let me ask you, what are the key lessons you learned while working directly with the DOJ-appointed monitor?
I think first and foremost, it's that when you have a major compliance incident, no matter if it rises to the level of an enforcement action or if it simply is a reputational issue, you need first and foremost to focus on root causes. And to the extent that there's systemic challenges within a business from an ethics and compliance perspective, I learned that you should really look at the underlying business processes first that were not effective in preventing, detecting, or addressing the misconduct as it was taking place within the business. Because an ethics and compliance program needs to be built on a solid foundation. So if there are not robust third-party onboarding processes or ongoing monitoring processes, if your hiring practices don't include robust oversight of referral hiring, if there are gaps in those sort of core functions outside of ethics and compliance, then the program is really going to be a patchwork over that. So you really need to ensure that you have those building blocks in place before you can build an ethics and compliance program on top of that. And if you don't address those issues early enough in a monitorship, it can certainly lead to challenges down the road. So that would be my advice first and foremost, is look at the business processes that are related to the areas of where there may have been compliance challenges, and address those first. And then simultaneously with that, be building and enhancing the program on top of it.
It's so tempting, isn't it, to play whack-a-mole? But as you say, the foundations are everything.
No, that's really where the strategy comes into place. It would be very easy to take the DOJ's guidance and treat it as a checklist. Yep, we've got the rewards and incentives in place. Yes, we have our CEO who's making all the statements, but you don't want to have a bunch of pieces of a program kind of hanging all over the place that aren't connected by what I think of as the North Star, or disparate pieces of the program all over the organization without it hanging together. And that's really where strategy is so important.
And one other thing I'm thinking that the monitorship might force is you having to show measured improvement over time. And that's something we all struggle with. So can you tell us a little bit about how you achieve that? How do you manage to show maybe the baseline and then the improvement and the journey that you're on?
So I think it really depends on what the starting point is. So if, and this is without reference to any particular program that I may have been working with in the past, but if there are entire parts of the program that have yet to be developed at all, then it's very easy to track progress, right? Because if you had not been risk rating certain of your operations, or if you had not been assessing all of your relationships, then simply getting that process online is tremendous progress. Of course, that first run at establishing any new risk management process is the heaviest lift. And there's always room for continuous improvement after that, right? Maybe taking third-party management as an example, you may find that you have overbalanced your risk, right? So where you have an inordinate percentage of your third-party population has been rated as high risk, which doesn't actually reflect your risk appetite or reflect reality from what you understand from other sources of information. But just having gotten all of those third parties risk rated in the first place, huge accomplishment. In the next phase, you adjust your algorithm, you adjust your risk calculations, and you right size your overall population. So I wouldn't say that you can really track progress in your program when you are building a program from a purely data-driven perspective. When you're in a more mature program, that is certainly much more possible. And that's where the data analytics in particular really comes into play, because you're not just talking about whether the program is in place and what your key performance indicators are. So how many transactions are we assessing? How many third parties have we reviewed and are we monitoring? That's just one measure of success. The real sign of maturity is when you're able to talk about whether the risks are managed effectively and how you know that from a data perspective. Simply building the program, you can report on progress and speak to progress from more of a narrative and a substantive perspective. But the long-term goal is definitely to get to those numbers, to be able to explain in hard figures how your risks are well managed.
No one thought we were going to get a masterclass today at the beginning of the year, but here we are. I'm thinking we should be writing to the deans of our law schools and getting you as an adjunct professor so compliance can be part of law school. This is so interesting, so helpful, honestly, even as I prepare for my own annual reports and sharing the progress that we've been making at Zendesk. Let me pivot from big tech and big telecom to big energy. So you were at Anadarko Petroleum, and I understand that you were asked to advise on some capacity building work with the government of Mozambique. Now, I like to think that compliance is about being the office of unlock. It's my new favorite hashtag. And I know that rather than just talk about the risks, you took it upon yourself at Anadarko to de-risk and facilitate the opportunity. Can you talk to us about that process?
Sure, absolutely. And maybe I'll take just a little bit of a step back to explain how I even found myself having that opportunity. Sure. And this is because one of my biggest pieces of advice, which I've already shared, is, you know, jump into the unexpected because you have no idea where it will take you. So I was getting on in my career in big law and was very much on partnership track. I was very happy. I loved the work. I found it incredibly rewarding. I'd really, after almost 10 years in, I'd really honed in and focused on financial crime enforcement and was very passionate about the work, had a great community, a great network. Never imagined changing anything. And one of the senior partners in my group came to me one day and said, and I was based in DC at the time, we have an oil and gas client in Houston who is getting ready to take a final investment decision on a project in Mozambique. And they need someone full time to be helping to advise on the ethics and compliance program and de-risking the project. And this was back on the heels of the tuna boat scandal. So Mozambique was certainly within the eye of the regulators, and there was a great deal of focus and attention in the national and international press. And the role would require me to essentially relocate to Houston, and I would be seconded on a full-time basis to the oil and gas company. And I was not excited about spending who knew how long away from my family, who would need to stay in DC for their own professional career reasons. But I took the leap anyway. I thought it would be a great opportunity to understand what reality was like for my clients and learn to be an even better advisor to the business, have a much more practical perspective than I think you can possibly develop by only working within the four walls of a big law firm. And so I did it. And I had an apartment in Houston and I commuted back and forth to DC on the weekends. And it was a difficult but extraordinary experience. And eventually, as the project developed, I had the opportunity to begin working in Mozambique directly. And that just seemed like such a different career path than I ever anticipated I would be on or opportunity to have, that when the opportunity to truly move in-house presented itself, I just leapt. And then I spent about 18 months working on the ground in Mozambique on a 6 to 8 week rotation. And then I'd come home for a couple of weeks. And my role was quite literally to be on the ground with our security professionals, our social relations team, our government affairs team, and helping to coach them and guide them through their engagement with Mozambican authorities, with our local communities, in order to ensure we were addressing the needs of the project, but also.
I want to just go back to the word de-risk, because I find it fascinating. Again, another thing I would love to have in my title or be known for, de-risking business opportunities. Tell us just a little bit more about what that means then for you and what that meant in Mozambique.
Sure. As is commonplace, anytime there are mega projects, mega infrastructure projects, mega industrial projects, there are often commitments that are made to help engage the country directly in the project and ensure that it's an opportunity that's shared equally across all sectors of society. And for me, with working on the Mozambique project, one of the most invaluable experiences that I had was engaging with the industry at all levels in order to help ensure that everyone understood what the expectations were as to how we would conduct business in relation to the project. And sometimes you're coming into countries where, and this was the case in Mozambique, where almost everyone who we were relying on in the ecosystem to help support the project had never worked with an American company before. And so understandably didn't have any sort of appreciation of the types of risks that American companies face and that they need to manage. So it gave us an amazing opportunity to help raise awareness and sophistication and capacity of other operators in the oil and gas, whether they're specifically in oil and gas or whether they're in the other sectors that are necessary to support a mega project, from catering to training and public awareness about the project and social engagement organizations. And so we were all able to work together in order to level set and ensure we were all on the same page about doing business ethically. And it was incredibly rewarding.
Hey, I find that so moving. When we say that our compliance community works to make the world a better place and that you're superheroes, that is exactly what I mean. And there's an option there to really move into a market and make it better for everyone versus thinking about things being a race to the bottom. This is what I hear as a race to the top, that we're really unlocking a market, facilitating responsible business conduct for everyone. And that can only benefit the various stakeholders, the local communities, the American shareholders, our employees. Everyone wins if we lean in, as you said, and take the opportunity to see how we can improve, how we can help. And I'm not saying that, of course, from a US-centric position, but if we avoid markets for fear, we will never be part of the solution and never be part of creating a better business community. So grateful for you, to you for sharing your experience. Also, I wrote down the words, jump into the expected as you have no idea where it will take you. World-changing global business conduct. I love it. I love it. Gosh, don't even know where to go after that. One question I wanted to ask you is about culture, because you mentioned, I think earlier in the podcast, how it's a foundational piece and without it, the rest is gravy. What are the conditions that you try to create to have a healthy, responsible business conduct culture at work?
So I think it starts with the company's values. And I have been very privileged to, in every role I've had outside of private practice, to work with companies that in one way or another truly had integrity and the company's wider role in the world at the heart of everything they do. And that focus about your role, the company's role in the world at large, may not specifically be with respect to leading with integrity or ethics and compliance. But if a company has a higher sense of obligation or even just appreciation and awareness, then that is the most important building block that you can get a foothold on in order to further embed your kind of integrity-driven business message from a culture perspective. I think the other piece that is, there's increasing awareness about how incredibly important it is to the effort, is ensuring the engagement and the commitment and the buy-in of leaders at all levels of the company. Because you can have a CEO who says all of the right things, but if it's not heard and acknowledged and acted upon at every level below that, then it doesn't really have much of an impact. And all of the studies show that employees are much more responsive to the actions and the conduct of their own line manager than of anyone in the C-suite, which, you know, particularly at companies that have tens of thousands of employees, feels like it's on another planet, right? So you relate most to the people who are closest to you, and the values that they act out in their day-to-day business are the most important. And from my perspective, the most important thing to do in order to impact your culture is to establish a network, assuming you don't have unlimited compliance resources, is to establish a network of champions within the organization that give you high compliance-minded, integrity-driven touch points with your lower levels of management, with your entry-level managers, your first-time managers, and up through sort of your middle management ranks, because those individuals have the greatest overall impact on your integrity-driven culture.
That's brilliant. And what I hear you saying is, yes, turn at the top is important, but mood in the middle is critical, and how you
absolutely
can do
that.
And then the first point you made also, I don't want to miss that, is the brand and the reputation, the identity as exhibited through the values is going to be critical as well. If a company really cares, then it can have an outsized impact.
Absolutely. And if the message, if the focus is more on environmental sustainability, for example, you can always dovetail the ethics and compliance message into whatever that wider piece is. Might take a little creative thinking and some close partnership with the organization that's driving that broader cultural piece, but the opportunity is there.
How can a culture survive isolated pockets of bad behavior?
By being very transparent. Being transparent about how it happened and why it happened. Being transparent about the consequences and treating it as an opportunity to have open conversations about the realities that the business is facing on the ground. Ensuring it's a safe space for people to speak up and ask questions so that when there are difficult scenarios, people know where to go to get guidance so that hopefully the best decisions can be made in the interest of the company.
No, I love that. And it's really the epitome of doing hard things well, isn't it? By, you know, facing it head on and being as transparent as you can. I remember some advice at the SEC conference in Chicago where we were given, if you can explain what happened during an investigation, you should, right? You should not miss an opportunity to educate the company on what happened. Even if you have to anonymize details, it's good to let people know the success stories, the lessons learned, the things that went wrong and the consequences.
I'm a big fan of recurring, consistent, and reliable compliance communications. So one approach that I've seen work effectively in the past is to have a quarterly all-employee newsletter or quarterly post to your company's internal blog feed or whatever the primary source of written communication is at your company, and to meet a consistent commitment to communicate information back to the organization about ethics and compliance issues. Whether you use that platform just for reminders or you use it as an opportunity when situations are appropriate is to present anonymized real-world scenarios that employees are facing, it keeps issues top of mind. It also creates an environment where people feel comfortable talking about those things. So you're feeding scenarios to your managers at all levels that they can then discuss with employees and situations that they should be sensitive to. So I'd really encourage others to take advantage of existing recurring communications channels and plug into those opportunities to feed relevant content, including addressing when difficult ethical situations arise.
Hey, these are some fantastic practical tips for the compliance officer that gets kept up at night with various things. Now, speaking about being kept up at night, I heard that you were sleeping on the streets of DC lately. What's going on there?
Yes, there is an incredible organization out there called Covenant House that I came to learn of through Cisco, who's been a longtime supporter. What I didn't know or appreciate is that most homeless shelters only accept adults who are over the age of 25. And so there is an incredible gap in support that is available for, in particular, individuals who may be emerging from the foster care system at the age of 18, who suddenly are on their own and independent and have no support network or safety net and are not eligible or not able to take advantage of the social services that are available through community shelters or otherwise. So Covenant House very specifically focuses on and supports that young youth community and helping to give them the life skills, the educational opportunities, and the stability to be able to be successful adults. So every year they do an annual sleep out to raise awareness about youth homelessness. And it was an incredible opportunity to give back to the DC community.
Such important work. And I want our listeners to know that this wasn't in the summer. This was actually in DC winter, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and no complaints. The weather was absolutely beautiful and mild, and we had it very easy compared to what thousands of youth face in the United States every day. A very worthwhile endeavor. I'd highly recommend checking out the organization.
Thank you for your service in making people aware of what's going on in those communities that are in need. Really important. Another story from the DMV. You recently invited me to a DC meetup for compliance professionals in the area, and sadly, I wasn't able to make that one, but I plan to make the next one. Can you tell us a little bit about that opportunity?
Yeah, I have to say this has been, since I transitioned out of my role at Ericsson, I was between my role in Mozambique and then my role at Ericsson, I had been basically traveling for 5 years straight and therefore had not really connected with the ethics and compliance community within DC since I moved out of my big law role. And I happened to learn about these networks through another friend, and it has been an incredible opportunity to get to know others who practice here in DC across all kinds of industries. And I've come to learn that there are these regional communities all over the country. So I would encourage, get on LinkedIn and talk to your friends and find out what the opportunities might be out there, because I've met some wonderful people who are now friends, not just professional colleagues, and who have such practical and valuable insights to share from their experience. It's been an incredibly fun and rewarding part of returning to my home base here in the DC community.
I love that. I know Gitanjali Sakuja is very active in organizing the DC one, so she'll be one of our guests later on this year, thankfully. Reach out to Haley if you want to join the DC one. And mentoring, community building, and paying it forward is super important to you. So I'd like to just ask you a question about your mentors or the community and how they've impacted your career journey, and maybe the best piece of advice you would pay forward to our listeners.
That is one of the topics that I enjoy talking about most. I'm firmly committed to ensuring that the ladder is available to everyone who's coming up in the community after me. I would say whenever you're aware of an opportunity, I always make a concerted effort to connect someone who I know may be a really good fit with that opportunity, because that's certainly how I found my way in-house and into the ethics and compliance world, where I just had a random opportunity to do a secondment at an oil and gas company in Houston. And always be conscious of others. And that has certainly served me well in my career and helping me to get to where I am. And you never know where paying it forward will also pay rewards. So it all comes back. It's a holistic circle.
I love that. And any New Year's resolutions, Haley?
Be even more engaged. I feel like I just started scratching the surface, particularly here with the DC community last year and the last couple months since I took on my new role. And so I want to be even more committed to getting to know my colleagues across the organization.
Oh, I'm right there with you. I can't believe how much you've taught us today. So thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. You've got Haley, super foster mum of great puppies in compliance. Volunteer in the community, mentor, friend. I'm so grateful to you for spending the time with us. I would say, if I were to give you any advice to your former self, Georgetown Law, I would say, you rock, Haley, and keep on doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
It's been a real pleasure. And to our Great Women in Community, Great Women in Compliance community, thank you so much for spending some time with Haley and I. We will see you in a week or two with the next podcast, and look out for each other. Take care. Happy New Year.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Great Women in Compliance. We hope you'll join us in honoring the great women in the compliance field by subscribing to this podcast and leaving a review.